Today at Reader's Corner, we welcome Larry Diamond, author of Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Ill Winds is a call to action against the rising authoritarianism that challenges our world order and the very value of liberty. Professor Diamond has watched with mounting unease as illiberal rulers rose in Hungary, Poland, Turkey, the Philippines, and beyond, while China and Russia grew increasingly bold and bullying. Then, with President Trump's election at home, the global retreat from freedom spread from democracy's margins to its heart. Ill Winds offers concrete, deeply informed suggestions to fight polarization, reduce the influence of money in politics, and make every vote count. Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, a professor of political science and sociology at Stanford, and a past director of its Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law. He is the author of numerous books, including The Spirit of Democracy, The Struggle to Build Free Societies Throughout the World, and a founding co-editor of the Journal of Democracy. Larry Diamond, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you.
Perhaps we should begin with a look at democracy's recent history. You refer in your book to democracy's Big Bang as the period when the proportion of democracies increased, but then along comes the third reverse wave. Maybe you can refresh our memories just how that comes about.
Well, keep in mind, in the mid-1970s, Bob, the world was mainly composed of authoritarian regimes, and American foreign policy was mainly, during the Cold War, pragmatically embracing our authoritarian regimes against their Soviet and Chinese-supported authoritarian regimes. But this was not a happy picture to many members of the United States Congress, who began to press for human rights to be more prominent, a feature of American foreign aid. Jimmy Carter came to be elected and started pressuring military regimes in Latin America. The Portuguese Revolution happened in 1974 and overturned a dictatorship. Francisco Franco died in the mid-1970s, and Spain made a transition. Greece lost a war with Turkey, and the military regime collapsed there. And so you started seeing in the mid and late 1970s a wave of democratic transitions in Western Europe and Latin America, with the United States under Carter's presidency beginning now clearly to align with democracy and human rights. Then President Reagan, you'll recall, Bob, came in 1981 and was kind of wary of Carter's posture. But when people power arose in the Philippines and again against General Pinochet in Chile and so on, and on the streets of South Korea lobbying for an end to military dictatorship, President Reagan and Secretary George Shultz aligned with these popular movements, and democratic transitions happened in those countries. And then, of course, it was Ronald Reagan who took a tough stand against the Soviet empire and said at the front of the Berlin Wall, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." And, you know, it was only a year or two later that they did. And we had the big bang, the second half of the third wave of democratization, with the wave of transitions in Central and Eastern Europe and in sub-Saharan Africa and more broadly in Asia. And by the early 1990s, for the first time in the history of the world, a majority of states in the world were at least electoral democracies.
So what's different about the democracies of today as opposed to the days you've just described? And I think in your book, you talk about repressive and aggressive.
Right. Well, the most important difference between then and now is that there are fewer democracies. The percentage of democracies in states over 1 million people peaked in 2006 at about 57%. And since then, it's been in decline. In fact, today, we're back to the pre-end of Cold War period, so the pre-1991 period. Today, only 48% of the states over 1 million population are democracies. And what's different also is you see these illiberal and populist trends of rising support for demagogues and illiberal populists who try to divide people and turn the people against the democratic norms and institutions and promote intolerance and racial and religious bigotry and xenophobia rather than tolerance and a more kind of shared democratic set of norms. And this is a very dangerous new mentality that has been unleashed on democracies around the world.
You share some polls with your readers, international polls, that compare America's liberal democracy to China's model of dictatorship and state-run capitalism. How does that come off for America? For liberal democracy, I should say.
Well, I'd say the picture is mixed. The recent polling data shows a very significant decline in America's standing in the world, because I think they see American democracy as troubled, polarized, dysfunctional. And many people around the world perceive that we have a president now who isn't really democratic and doesn't really believe in democracy. At the same time, I think two other things need to be noted. While for a time, the stature of the People's Republic of China was rising around the world, and more people had sympathetic views of China and wanted to be closer to China, that's begun to change as China's been throwing around its power in bullying fashion and becoming increasingly authoritarian internally and cracking down on Hong Kong in a very brutal fashion. And also, while there's been some erosion in public support for democracy, particularly among young people in the US and around the world, still don't favor authoritarian alternatives.
Perhaps the best evidence of China's most sweeping goals when it comes to infiltrating democracies can be found in Australian politics. I must admit, I did not follow that as carefully as you have, and you shared some things with your reader that I thought were really interesting about Beijing's goal of, I guess you call it, globalization 2.0.
Well, increasingly we have in the world now, Bob, a set of authoritarian actors who are using what we call sharp power to try to intervene in an unduly, inappropriately influence, shape, intimidate, and censor the public dialogue and political workings of democracies around the world. I was part of a working group co-sponsored by the Hoover Institution and the Asia Society in New York that produced a report, China's Influence in American Interests, that found very troubling levels of Chinese influence and penetration in the United States and other democracies around the world. And as you note, none more alarmingly than Australia, where China has bullied and intimidated college students on major Australian campuses, organized their Chinese overseas students to protest any lecture or event that would be critical of China, not to mention that might have a high-profile speaker like the Dalai Lama or someone from a dissident from China or Hong Kong or something. And in Australia today, as in really the United States, it's very hard to find a Chinese language radio station or newspaper that isn't in the pocket of Beijing and basically sprouting the Chinese Communist Party line. Moreover, in Australia, you now have a number of former ministers and political leaders who are being paid lavishly by Chinese companies on consulting contracts and you know, brokering deals and so on, who just happened by coincidence to be spouting the Chinese line on the South China Sea being a Chinese lake, and saying that Australia's future lies with China and not the United States. So the role of money, intimidation, penetration, and so on is very, very sobering and requires a new era of what we call constructive vigilance.
You're listening to Larry Diamond. He's the author of Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. And let's talk about that for a minute, because I want to make sure our listeners understand that we've covered this ground of democracy losing and autocratic governments rising around the world in a few books at Reader's Corner over the last 3 or 4 years. Yours is the first one I've read that really nails down some prescriptions for what we can do about it. And I want to talk about Russia and I want to talk about China, but since we're on China right now, why don't you just give us a few thoughts? So for one thing, you do give Trump some credit for cracking down on China's theft of our intellectual property, but I think in my words, you consider it a pretty ham-handed approach. Maybe you can explain.
I do think that I'm really inclined to say the Trump administration's more robust and vigilant posture toward the People's Republic of China and willingness to expose it and confront it and to prosecute Chinese spying in the United States will be looked back on as the most important and constructive foreign policy achievement of his first term. I don't think that it's without problems, because first of all, President Trump has been quite unpredictable and regrettably silent about China's crackdown on and destruction of human rights and governance autonomy in Hong Kong. And I think some of the rhetoric coming from President Trump about China can be counterproductive in terms of demonizing all Chinese citizens or China itself in a way that leads to a xenophobic reaction. Xenophobia, Bob, is not what we want. In fact, it really is counterproductive. Recent research by Jennifer Pan, my colleague at Stanford, has shown that Chinese students, when they come to the United States, you know, they're generally open to the American model. It might be part of what attracted them to want to study in the United States. And when they are given time and space to kind of quietly become part of our extended community and read and think and listen on their own, you know, their minds may change on a lot of things, and they may come perhaps reluctantly at first, maybe quietly, but over time to see the values of a more democratic and open society. But when they come here and they're automatically, you know, cast into a common light as enemies of the United States or fronts for Chinese influence without any evidence, then they retreat into a kind of patriotic reaction against this kind of stereotyping. So what we need is a very patient, careful, empirical, vigilant approach that doesn't assume that all Chinese students and scholars who come here are working for the Chinese Communist Party, but that vets them and responds to behavior and not nationality. One behavior that I think we cannot tolerate is Chinese consulates trying to organize their Chinese students into monitoring and spying on their fellow Chinese students in the United States. Another behavior that we cannot tolerate is China using their Confucius Institutes and the funding this provides to many colleges and universities for Chinese language instruction in the United States to try and censor political dialogue in the United States or tell American universities what kind of speakers they can have or what kind of events and programs. And another behavior that we cannot tolerate is Chinese scientists and engineers coming from the Seven Sons of National Defense the universities explicitly linked to the People's Liberation Army, coming from those military-linked universities to do research in the United States and lying about their real affiliations so that we won't be alert to the fact that they're trying to acquire American sensitive technology and science in artificial intelligence or quantum computing to take it back to modernize the People's Liberation Army. So our constructive vigilance has to be tied to behavior and not nationality.
Larry, tell us about George Kennan's long telegram and how it predicts Putin's global assault on democracies across the West.
Well, I think that the long telegram that our then prominent diplomat in Moscow, George Kennan, sent from Moscow at the end of the Cold War is really an astonishingly relevant document to the time that we're living in. Not so much for what it says about Russia now, though unfortunately much of it remains true about the mentality of the Putin regime, but what it says about the way the communist authorities in China think and about their ambitions to trash American democracy, engage in comprehensive misinformation and disinformation, and lift, in this case, China, to a position of global dominance. And I think that Kennan's long telegram warns us of the need to be alert to that and to be vigilant against it without, as I said, overreacting. And one of the things I found so incredibly relevant to our moment and so in a way inspiring is Kennan's warning that we have to remain true to our democratic values. I just managed to find a passage that I think it's particularly relevant that I quote in the book from the long telegram. Kennan urged us to find, quote, the courage and self-confidence to cling to our own methods and conceptions of human society. The greatest danger that can befall us is that we shall allow ourselves to become like those with whom we are coping. So we have to defend and improve our democracy as the best way of competing against this global authoritarian project.
So in defending our democracy, how can the West stand up to Putin and his Russian kleptocrats? You have some specific recommendations.
Well, just in light of your last sentence and my previous remarks, I'll mention three baskets of policy initiative or policy principle. The first basket is that we have to push back against global kleptocracy, the means by which the Putin regime and its allies and other autocrats around the world, including many senior elites in the Chinese Communist Party, are sending their ill-gotten wealth to Western banks, Western stock markets, Western property markets, and laundering it through elaborate schemes of movement through front companies, dummy companies that disguise the real origin of the wealth in order to then be able to secure it and enjoy it in our wonderful democracy in the United States and in England, France, Germany, Switzerland, Australia, and so on. We need full transparency, Bob, so that you can't move your money through a front company and disguise the real nature of it. We need to ban anonymous shell corporations. We need to ban anonymous real estate purchases. And we need to modernize and strengthen the Foreign Agents Registration Act so we know when somebody is lobbying for these shadowy foreign interests. And we need much tougher anti-money laundering laws that will make it more difficult for these Russian and Chinese authoritarian front actors to penetrate our economy, to penetrate our democracy, and to reduce the quality of it. Secondly, we need to go on the offensive again for democracy, for democratic values and principles. We used to have something, you will remember, Bob, called the United States Information Agency that waged a campaign not of, you know, matching Soviet disinformation with our own, but rather leading with our values. You know, Edward R. Murrow, the famous former CBS News correspondent who became the head, the director of the U.S. Information under John F. Kennedy, said, "The best propaganda is the truth, and the worst are lies, because over time people will see the truth and it will have the credibility to endure over time." So we need to lead with truthful reporting and rebuttal of Soviet and Chinese disinformation and promote, you know, universal values of freedom, critical inquiry, tolerance, the rule of law, and the classical writings, both in Chinese traditions and in Western traditions, that affirm principles of limited and good and transparent government. And finally, I think the pushback against global authoritarianism has to involve a very broad bipartisan and nonpartisan effort in the United States to reform and renew our own democracy. We can't go to this global conflict, this global campaign for democracy and democratic values, with a democracy as polarized, diminished, and degraded as the one we have now. And we need reforms to restore the health of our democracy. I think ranked choice voting is one. You mentioned multi-member districts in our preceding conversation before we went on the air, another interesting alternative. And I would say the time has come, Bob, with the dilemma we're in of this polarized debate over the Supreme Court, to institute term limits for the United States Supreme Court, a reform that 75% of the American people consistently have favored in recent polls. You know, if we know that a justice is only going to be on the court for 18 years and not maybe 40, the stakes in the confirmation battle may be reduced a little bit.
You're listening to Larry Diamond. He's the author of Ill Winds: Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. He will be the keynote speaker at the 37th Annual Frank Church Conference, How Democracies Survive and Thrive in the 21st Century, on Friday, November 20th, 10 a.m. You have a chapter in your book on saving the internet, making the internet safe for democracy, Larry, and I found it very interesting, especially in light of the fact that not long before we went on the air, the Department of Justice announced it's taking antitrust action against Google, which you address in your book and offer a cautionary note about such action, given what we're up against when dealing with China in particular and some of its mammoth technology companies.
Right. Well, I think that we need much more vigorous action to, I don't want to say regulate the internet companies, because I hope it doesn't come to that. I want to induce and persuade the major internet platforms to behave more responsibly and to vet their content more forthrightly, to not only flag, but when necessary, remove outrageously false content. They are not just, you know, providers of some kind of platform. They really are, in the end, publishers who have some editorial responsibility. Now, Twitter has gone the furthest in flagging and in some cases removing outrageously false, and in the case of the COVID epidemic, dangerously false content, even from the President of the United States. And Facebook now has an appeals panel that will hear complaints and make decisions about the vetting of content. I think Google and Facebook need to do much more to be responsible actors and not allow the internet to become a sewer for dangerous, violent extremism and deliberately, patently, demonstrably false and even violence-inducing content.
The other side of this coin when it comes to dealing with the incredible impact technology has on our lives is what we can do about it as digital citizens. And you talk about part of the problem being civic online reasoning. Help us with where we're falling short when it comes to educating our young people about how to use the internet.
Well, we are not doing enough of that is the core problem. And I think that, first of all, we need to revive civics as a major theme of instruction in American schools, middle schools, and most of all, secondary school. And civics is not, Bob, just about content. You know, what are the three branches of government? Why do we have a Bill of Rights? This sort of thing. It's also about norms. You know, why is tolerance and restraint and truth, why are these such important principles for a democracy? Why is it important to live in a democracy? What's the link between democracy and freedom, avoiding tyranny? Civics now needs to include a prominent component about responsible behavior on the internet and avoiding disinformation and verifying facts on the internet. And I think that we need to develop curricula so that every secondary school in the United States can teach these skills. It's not rocket science. You can learn how to move around across different streams of information to verify content, and it's a skill that can be taught. I'd like to go beyond, however, and say that deliberation really requires not just reflection by individuals and careful vetting of facts and reflection and pursuit of different arguments by individuals. Deliberation is inherently a collective project where we talk to one another and reason with one another based on evidence and, you know, the consideration of alternative arguments. And this is why we think the model of deliberative democracy and the deliberative polls we've been doing, including American One Room 13 months ago in September of 2019, is an important model for getting Americans to step outside their filter bubbles, outside their tribal communities of impassioned dialogue, and consider alternative arguments and talk to people who have different points of view.
Well, that certainly is key in these days. There's no question about that. You opened the last chapter of your book reminding us, even though we've all seen It's a Wonderful Life many times, of George Bailey's guardian angel, Clarence, who reminds him of his great gift. Maybe you want to relate for us how you see that applying to our times.
Well, first of all, I want to say, Bob, thank you for remembering that. It's a Wonderful Life is one of my favorite movies.
Same here.
Young people who haven't seen it will watch it at some point. There's a very moving moment when the angel is standing on the bridge, the angel who appears in human form, when Jimmy Stewart is about to jump off the bridge and commit suicide and says, George, let me show you what your life, what the world would have been like if you had not been here. And he goes back and he shows what the world would become 10 years later without George Bailey there. And, you know, I'd say it's the same about the United States and the world. We may be tired of bearing undue global responsibilities. We may think that, gee, you know, we're spending a lot of money in NATO and on the Korean Peninsula and so on. But to stand up against global authoritarianism requires coordination and leadership among the global democracies. And we won the Cold War, not just because of the United States and its strength, its principle, its democratic resolve, but because of alliances. And it takes a powerful democracy to rally, cement, and lead these alliances, both in Asia and in Europe. And we are still the indispensable country in that way. And if we remain on the front lines of this with our European allies, with our Asian partners, Japan, Korea, tacitly Taiwan, Australia, New Zealand, to some extent Singapore, and even a communist country, Vietnam, that doesn't want to be a pawn of the People's Republic of China, I am very confident that we will be able to prevent China from becoming the dominant totalitarian power in the world, and that we will see at some point a fourth wave of global democratization.
Well, Larry, that's a fitting place to leave our conversation today. And I want to remind our readers that they can hear more from you on Friday, November 20th, 10 a.m., where we're going to have a virtual 37th annual Frank Church Conference, How Democracies Survive and Thrive in the 21st Century. I can't think of a more appropriate book and author to present than you, Larry, on Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner, and we look forward to hearing from you at the Frank Church Conference.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Professor Diamond will keynote the 37th Annual Frank Church Conference. You can register for the conference webinar on the Boise State Frank Church Institute website. Look for Fridays with Frank. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.